90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Suffice it to say, it is highly unusual to see shootouts in open sea like that. It's not something that happens every day. It's something, frankly, that hasn't happened with Cuba in a very long time.
Four armed Cuban exiles on a speedboat were killed Wednesday in a shootout with Cuban border troops. Cuba says the men were attempting to infiltrate the country. Six other men were injured and are being held in hospital in Cuba. This comes as Cuba's facing a growing humanitarian crisis due to a U.S. oil blockade. We'll speak to Code Pink's Medea Benjamin just back from Cuba. Then to the massacre of aid workers in Gaza. An 11-month investigation by Forensic Architecture and Earshot has uncovered how Israeli forces killed 15 Palestinian aid workers a year ago, then tried to cover it up. We'll speak to the investigators in London, then to the Committee to Protect Journalists.
129 journalists were killed worldwide in 2025, making it the deadliest year on record since the Committee to Protect Journalists began collecting this data in 1992. Israel was responsible for two-thirds of these killings in attacks on the press in Gaza, Yemen, and Iran.
We'll look at the record number of journalists being killed worldwide, as well as a new CPJ report on Palestinian journalists being tortured in Israeli prisons. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. and Iranian negotiators have begun indirect negotiations in Geneva over Iran's nuclear program after President Trump ordered the largest deployment of U.S. forces to the Middle East since the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in 2003. Ahead of the talks, the Trump administration imposed new sanctions on 30 people accused of enabling Iran's oil sales and weapons production. This comes as Trump's envoy, Steve Witkoff, is claiming Iran has enough fissile material to make a nuclear bomb within days. But several nuclear experts say Iran's nuclear program hasn't advanced since the U.S. and Israeli military struck them last June. This is Iran's Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi.
We were negotiating last June when Israel attacked us, and then the U.S. joined that attack. So that memory is still fresh for us. The wounds of that aggression is still alive in our minds. So we cannot forget that once we negotiating with the U.S. and then they decided to attack us.
Meanwhile, independent journalist Ida Chavez is reporting that Democratic lawmakers on the House Foreign Affairs Committee are trying to prevent a vote on an Iran War Powers resolution sponsored by Congress members Ro Khanna and Thomas Massey. The bill would require every member of Congress to go on the record about a potential U.S. war with Iran. Four Cuban exiles were killed Wednesday in a shootout between Cuban border guards and a U.S. speedboat carrying 10 Cuban exiles. According to the Cuban government, the men on the Florida-registered speedboat opened fire when Cuban forces approached the boat for an inspection off the northeast coast of Cuba. The Cuban guards then fired back, killing four of the men. Six others were injured or now being held in Cuba in hospital. The Cuban government says the men were attempting to carry out, quote, an infiltration with terrorist ends, unquote. Cuban media reports the men were carrying weapons, Molotov cocktails, bulletproof jackets, and camouflage gear. On Wednesday, U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said the U.S. will investigate what happened. Rubio was speaking at a gathering of Caribbean leaders who expressed alarm over the growing humanitarian crisis in Cuba due to the U.S. oil blockade that's cut off the island from desperately needed fuel. On Wednesday, two Mexican Navy ships departed from Veracruz with over 1,000 tons of humanitarian aid for Cuba. Russian officials say they're discussing the possibility of providing fuel to Cuba. And on Wednesday, Canada became the latest country to pledge food aid to Cuba. We'll have more on this story after headlines with Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink, who's hoping to organize a humanitarian solidarity mission to Cuba next month. She's just back from the island. Dozens of international aid organizations have made a final appeal to the Israeli Supreme Court to prevent a de facto ban on their operations in Gaza and the occupied West Bank, set to take effect in early March. The 37 international groups, including Oxfam and Doctors Without Borders, collectively provide more than half of all food assistance in Gaza, operate the majority of field hospitals, and run all inpatient treatment for children suffering severe acute malnutrition. This comes amidst a surge of violence by Israeli soldiers and settlers targeting Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. On Tuesday, settlers set fire to vehicles and tents in the Palestinian village of Susia. This is resident Ahmed Al-Nawaja.
We were shocked when around 30 settlers arrived. They were carrying incendiary materials and burned this tent and that one. They burned the chicken coop. They burned all the furniture. They left nothing.
The U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem says it'll offer passport and consular services to U.S. citizens in two Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank. It's the first time the State Department's offered such services, a move the Palestinian Authority condemned as a, quote, clear violation of international law and a blatant favoring of the occupation authorities, unquote. A New York Times review finds key documents related to a woman who accused Donald Trump of assaulting her when she was a minor are missing from the Justice Department's release of the Epstein files. The missing documents are comprised of FBI memos summarizing interviews the agency conducted with the woman in 2019. She spoke to the FBI after Jeffrey Epstein was arrested and claimed she'd been sexually assaulted by both Donald Trump and Epstein in the 1980s, when she was just 13 years old. The Times notes, according to the index of the Epstein files, the FBI conducted four interviews with the woman and provided summaries of each interview. But only one of the summaries, which details her accusation against Epstein, was released by the Justice Department. On Wednesday, former U.S. Treasury Secretary Larry Summers said he'll resign as a professor at Harvard University at the end of the semester over his ties to Epstein. Summers had previously served as president of Harvard. Summers had been on leave since last November after the Harvard Crimson student newspaper detailed how Summers had asked Epstein for relationship advice, how to have an affair with a person he was mentoring. Meanwhile, Bob Kerry, the former Democratic senator from Nebraska, resigned from his role as chair of the company Monolith over his ties to Epstein. Nobel laureate Richard Axel also announced his resignation as co-director of Columbia University's Neuroscience Institute over his association with the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. The president and CEO of the World Economic Forum, Borja Brenda, said he was resigning after the forum launched an independent investigation into his relationship with Epstein. Meanwhile, Bill Gates has apologized to his staff of the charitable foundation over his ties to Epstein. Gates also acknowledged he had two affairs with Russian women that Epstein later discovered. According to a recording obtained by The Wall Street Journal, Gates admitted he first met with Epstein in 2011, years after Epstein had pleaded guilty in 2008 to soliciting a minor for prostitution. A federal judge has ruled the Trump administration's policy of deporting immigrants to third countries to which they have no ties is unlawful. In his ruling, U.S. District Judge Brian Murphy said that immigrants challenging the Department of Homeland Security's policy have the right to meaningful notice and can object before they're deported to a third country. In Buffalo, New York, a disabled Rohingya refugee from Burma has been found dead after he was abandoned by Border Patrol agents about 5 miles from his home. 56-year-old Nurulamin Shah Alam was mostly blind and spoke no English. His family told reporters no one at the Department of Homeland Security warned them or his lawyers that he'd been released from jail and dropped off alone outside a coffee shop on a cold winter night. Minnesota Congressmember Ilhan Omar is demanding an investigation into the arrest of her guest at the State of the Union Tuesday night. Alia Rahman was removed from the House chamber and jailed, all for standing silently during President Trump's speech. She described her arrest on Democracy Now.
I was not just removed and arrested. I was arrested so physically that two other attendees upstairs attempted to intervene in officers pulling on my shoulders after I told them I have a torn rotator cuff tendon and multiple cartilage tears in both of my shoulders.
In a statement, Minneapolis Congressmember Ilhan Omar wrote, quote, "The heavy-handed response to a peaceful guest sends a chilling message about the state of our democracy," unquote. Alia Rahman is a U.S. citizen. She was injured last month when federal immigration agents smashed her car window in Minneapolis and dragged her out of her car. She's autistic, reportedly telling them she was disabled repeatedly. She was detained at the Whipple Federal Building and later released without charge. The Trump administration announced Wednesday it's freezing more than $250 million in Medicaid reimbursements to the state of Minnesota. In announcing the move, Vice President J.D. Vance cited a fraud scandal that's been linked to a handful of Somali Americans in Minneapolis. Nearly 1.3 million people in Minnesota receive some form of Medicaid coverage, or about a quarter of all state residents. In a statement, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz condemned the Trump administration's actions, writing, quote, "The agents Trump allegedly sent to investigate fraud are shooting protesters and arresting children. His DOJ is gutting the U.S. Attorney's Office and crippling their ability to prosecute fraud. And every week, Trump pardons another fraudster," unquote. President Trump's nominee to become the next U.S. Surgeon General appeared before the Senate Health, Education, Labor and Pensions Committee on Wednesday, where she declined to encourage parents to have their kids vaccinated against measles and influenza. Casey Means is a wellness influencer, author and entrepreneur. She and her brother, Callie Means, are key figures in the Make America Healthy Again movement, advisors to Health Secretary RFK Jr. during his 2024 presidential campaign. Casey Means has a medical degree from Stanford University, but did not complete her surgical residency and allowed her medical license to expire in 2024. Under questioning from Senator Tim Kaine, Means repeatedly refused to state whether she agreed with Health Secretary RFK Jr. that there's no evidence flu vaccines prevent serious disease.
A mountain of evidence about this. Do you believe that there's no evidence that there's the flu vaccine has efficacy in reducing serious injury or hospitalization? This is an easy one, doctor. This is an easy one.
I support the CDC's guidance on the flu vaccine, and I will always be working with the CDC, ACIP, and the agency.
So you believe it is an efficacious vaccine to reduce hospitalization? And
is or is not?
Is. You believe it is?
So as I said, I support the CDC's guidance on the flu vaccine.
Let me just say,
the artificial intelligence company Anthropic is dropping its core safety pledge in scaling its AI models. The company's reversal comes after Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth issued an ultimatum to Anthropic CEO Dario Amodei to grant the Pentagon full access to the company's AI models by Friday. Hegseth reportedly threatened to cancel a $200 million Pentagon contract and to declare Anthropic a supply chain risk, and even said he might invoke the Defense Production Act to force the company to tailor its AI models for military use. Amodei had previously warned against the use of artificial intelligence to help the U.S. government conduct mass surveillance and develop autonomous weapons. This comes as NBC News reports that in December, Anthropic agreed to allow the U.S. government to use its AI systems for missile and cyber defense purposes. And Brazil's Supreme Court has sentenced five men to prison terms after convicting them of plotting the 2018 assassination of Rio de Janeiro City Councilwoman Marielle Franco and her driver, Anderson Gomes. Among those found guilty were former Congressmember Chiquinho Brasio and his brother Domingos. Marielle Franco is a black lesbian known for her fierce criticism of police killings and Brazil's impoverished favela neighborhoods. On Wednesday, her widow, Monica Benicio, celebrated the Brazilian Supreme Court's unanimous ruling.
Marielle becomes a symbol, but because society has made her so, because it believes that this country can be much better than it is now. Justice for Marielle is not a slogan. It's a life task. It's the fight for building a society where people like Marielle and Anderson can live, flourish, and never be murdered for being who they are. And that's the message we leave here today, written in the history of Brazilian democracy.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Mimi Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. Four Cuban exiles were killed Wednesday in a shootout between Cuban border troops and a Florida-registered speedboat carrying 10 Cuban exiles. According to the Cuban government, the men on the speedboat opened fire when Cuban border troops approached the boat for an inspection off the northeast coast of Cuba. The Cuban troops then fired back, killing four of the six men. Six others were injured and are now being held in Cuba.
The Cuban government says the men were attempting to carry out, quote, an infiltration with terrorist ends, unquote. Cuban media reports the men were carrying weapons, Molotov cocktails, bulletproof jackets and camouflage gear. Cuban Foreign Minister Bruno Rodriguez said, quote, Cuba has had to face numerous terrorist and aggressive infiltrations from the United States since 1959 with a high cost in lives, injuries and material damage. A rigorous investigation is being carried out to clarify the facts, he said. On Wednesday, U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said the U.S. will investigate what happened.
Suffice it to say, it is highly unusual to see shootouts in open sea like that. It's not something that happens every day. It's something, frankly, that hasn't happened with Cuba in a very long time. But we're going to find out. We're not going to base our conclusions on what they've told us.
Marco Rubio, who's Cuban-American, was speaking at a gathering of Caribbean leaders in St. Kitts and Nevis. At the meeting, regional leaders expressed alarm about the growing humanitarian crisis in Cuba due to a U.S. oil blockade that has cut off the island from desperately needed fuel. The Trump administration recently threatened new tariffs against any nation that sends fuel to Cuba, which has been under a U.S. economic embargo since 1962. The U.S. has been ratcheting up pressure on Cuba since early January when U.S. forces attacked Venezuela and abducted Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro and his wife Celia Flores.
On Wednesday, the Treasury Department announced it would partially ease the blockade and allow Cuba's private sector to import Venezuelan oil, but restrictions remain on the Cuban government. The U.S. move is widely seen as another attempt by the Trump administration to weaken the Cuban government. We go now to Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink. She was in Cuba 2 weeks ago providing humanitarian aid. She was also just in Venezuela. Code Pink, the Progressive International, and other organizations are planning to launch a land, sea, and air humanitarian solidarity mission to Cuba in late March. So if you can deal with this breaking news, the 10 Cuban men, apparently, in a speedboat headed to Cuba. Explain what you understand happened. At this point, four are now dead. Six have been taken by Cuba.
I understand that a boat that was carrying weapons and people who were going to infiltrate Cuban waters and somehow escape the U.S. Coast Guard, because they're not allowed to even go to Cuba, managed to get within 1 mile of Cuba's northern province of Santa Clara, and that they were approached by a Cuban Coast Guard that wanted their identification. The U.S. boat opened fire, and in the shootout, there were four Cubans living in the United States who were killed, and six were wounded. I should say that when the U.S. blows up boats in the Caribbean, when there are people in those boats that weren't killed, it goes back to kill them all. Instead, Cuba took the six to a hospital for treatment. I also want to say that the brother of one of those murders said, it was quoted in the AP story today, that his brother had fallen into a diabolical and obsessive quest to change the U.S. government, the Cuban government, a diabolical and obsessive quest. And I think that characterizes U.S. policy for the last 60 plus years.
So, Medea, could you say a little bit more? What is known about these 10, the four killed, the six detained? Were they all Cuban nationals, any of them American citizens?
They were all Cuban nationals living in the U.S. in Florida. Two of them were on a Cuban wanted list for prior criminal activities, attempts at terrorism. And we're learning as the time goes by about the others of them. This has happened before. While Marco Rubio said it's unusual to have a shootout in the seas, that's true. But it is not unusual to have terrorists infiltrating Cuban territory. In fact, there are in the history blowing up of tourist hotels so that tourists would be afraid to go to Cuba, and constant attempts to infiltrate. Of course, there are hundreds of attempts to kill Fidel Castro. The Southern Florida Cubans are obsessive and diabolical, and they must be stopped. And unfortunately, they are represented in our government, in our Congress, by people like Representative Maria Salazar, and also by Carlos Jimenez and Diaz-Balart. And they're represented at the highest level of government by our U.S. Secretary of State, Marco Rubio.
Well, let's go to Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who is, as we mentioned earlier, Cuban-American, speaking on Wednesday.
What the Cuban people should know is this, that if they are hungry and they are suffering, it's not because we're not prepared to help them. We are. It's that the people standing in the way of us helping them is their Communist Party. That's who's standing in the way. If they move out of the way, we're more than happy to work with individual Cubans so they can have an opportunity to feed their families and build their economy. But we are not the impediment. They are.
So, Medea, that is Marco Rubio. If you could explain, you were just in Cuba a couple of weeks ago. I mean, Cuba has been under sanctions, a U.S. embargo since 1962. But explain what's happened in the last months when sanctions have been so tightened that prices are so high for basic items. I mean, as he mentioned, people are hungry, that they're totally out of reach. And also the food scarcity that there is now in Cuba.
Yeah, what Marco Rubio said would be laughable were it not so tragic. On January 11th, Donald Trump said that no oil and no money would be going to Cuba, zero. This is, as you said, a policy that has been going on for over six decades now. And it has been tightened in such a medieval siege type of way by Donald Trump. To stop all oil from going to Cuba has created a terrible crisis where workers don't have transportation to get to work. When they get to work, there's no electricity. Students are having a hard time getting to school. The hospitals are having a hard time functioning. There's a terrible scarcity of medicines. The food is scarce and high priced. Farmers now don't have access to irrigation or fuel for tractors. This is a tragedy that's been going on and has been exacerbated since COVID. And with U.S. policies of putting Cuba on the state sponsor of terrorism list, which is something Donald Trump did, and unfortunately Biden was waited to the last week of his presidency to lift, and then it was put on right again. This means that Cuba can't function in the world trade system. It can't use the international banks. These sanctions that the U.S. put on are not just to stop U.S. companies. They're designed to stop other countries and companies around the world from dealing with Cuba. And so you don't have fuel. The garbage piles up in the streets. The mosquitoes proliferate. Mosquito-borne diseases proliferate. There's not the ability in the hospitals to take care of people. Cuba, once known for a lower infant mortality rate than in the United States, now infant mortality rate is rising. This is a tragedy. It's condemned every year by the world community, by everybody except the United States and Israel. And yet, it keeps going on. And I think now, finally, the world community, and especially in Latin America, is rising up to say, no, we cannot let this keep going on.
Canada has announced $8 million in funding for Cuba as the country grapples with President Trump's oil embargo, as the UN warns of a humanitarian catastrophe in Cuba. Can you talk about what Code Pink, Progressive International, and other groups are doing? Talk about what you plan for the next weeks.
Yeah, we are excited to announce that on March 21st, there will be a convergence in Havana of people arriving, getting there by boat, by plane. There are also a group, the People's Forum, that will be collecting and is collecting lots of solar panels, taking them through Mexico to ship to Cuba. And people can also come on their own. We have chartered a plane from Miami that will fit 100 people. And we will be going, the delegation that is Code Pink, Progressive International, and Global Health Partners, leaving on March 20th to 23rd. You can join us. Go to the CodePink.org page, and it's the first thing that will pop up. This is a time, actually, to go to Cuba. The Cubans have asked people to come in solidarity, to see the conditions there for themselves. We have to, especially in the United States, where we have such a responsibility for this catastrophe that is going on right now. We have to go there, we have to raise money for Cuba, and we have to protest Cuba policies in Congress. Call your Congressperson. We have to show Marco Rubio that the U.S. community is absolutely opposed to a policy designed to create hunger and desperation.
Finally, you also just came back from Venezuela. We're in New York, not far from where the Venezuelan president, Nicolas Maduro, and his wife are imprisoned at the detention center in Brooklyn. The USS Gerald Ford, the largest aircraft carrier that was used in that attack and the abduction, is now nearing Iran in a massive military buildup. Not clear if Venezuela, the U.S. attack there, will be the model for perhaps an attack on Iran. But tell us about, in this last minute, what you found in Venezuela.
We found that people are horrified by what the U.S. did of coming in and abducting their president and the first lady on bogus charges. People also are horrified that the U.S. people don't even know or care that over 120 people were killed in that operation. Also, that there has been this economic warfare against Venezuela as well, designed to create hunger and designed and led to a mass migration that then the U.S. doesn't want the Venezuelans here anymore. They create the problem and then go in and say, okay, we're going to fix it. We're going to take Venezuela's oil and start rev up production. But it was the U.S. that led to the decline of the production by not allowing the spare parts to come in, by not allowing the companies to actually work there. So we're calling for the freedom of Nicolas Maduro and Celia Flores. We're calling for a lifting of the sanctions because they haven't been lifted. We're calling for the U.S. to recognize the government now of acting President Delcy Rodriguez so that there can be diplomatic relations. But I just want to say to close that this is a time of the Monroe Doctrine being accelerated now to the Donroe Doctrine, where the U.S. thinks that it can go into any country in Latin America. And now they're focusing on Venezuela and Cuba, but they have their sights set on Colombia, on Mexico, on other places, and that we can cannot allow us to go back to the days of gunboat diplomacy, where the U.S. thinks that it is allowed to violate sovereign nations and it can have hegemony over the hemisphere. These are sovereign countries. We must leave them alone.
Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink, was just in Cuba providing humanitarian aid. Code Pink,